Rocks is supported by the Old Mill Restaurant, planning on opening soon in Roxbury, former site of the Public Lounge just a few years ago, and the former site of Roxbury's original grain mill and blacksmith shop 100 years ago. The new Old Mill Restaurant's decor will feature the original mill machinery and blacksmith artifacts, and be open every day for dinner, private parties, community events, and streamside dining in the summer. A place for folks to gather, talk, eat, drink, and party. The Old Mill Restaurant, planning on opening soon in the heart of Roxbury. More information at oldmillroxbury.com. WIOX is supported by CREA, a store designed as a source for sustainable artisanal products, including CREA's own jewelry made from reclaimed metals and ethically produced goods to wear and share. CREA, K-R-I-A. On Main Street in Margaretville. More information at KreaJewelry.com. WIOX is supported by Mountain Flame in Arkville, featuring a range of products for home heating solutions. A variety of fireplaces, wood stoves, and gas and pellet stoves are available and on display. For sales and service, Mountain Flame in Arkville. Warming home since 1980. Details at mountainflame.com.
Hi, I'm Diana Mason, the host of Health Cetera in the Catskills, every other Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on WIOX Roxbury, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, WIOXradio.org, and MTC Cable Channel 20.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20 and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. If you like what you hear, you can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio app. And this is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Good.
It was a nice warm day today. The March sun is feeling good.
Yeah, it's been a couple more cold days in the forecast, and that looks like it's about over. It's 30s and 40s or beyond all the way through the long-term forecast.
Yeah. Yeah, the sap season for maple sugaring looks like it'll be well underway. I've made about a gallon, so it has happened already in central Ulster County, but today should have something when I get home. Yesterday was absolutely frigid with the wind.
Yeah, no sap today.
That was cold. Yeah, that wind, man, just blew down everything. I had no power for 24 hours. People complain about Texas. We still haven't figured out winter and electricity yet here in New York.
Yeah, you have power now?
Yeah, we got it now, but no power. 24 hours, just none, you know. Every time the wind blows, everyone near me has a generator, pretty much. Hmm. And when I moved there 8 years ago or so, First time the storm came through and the power went out, I heard all these sounds that I wasn't used to. And I was like, those are generators. So that's just what happens when you live in the woods and you're at the end of the line, so to speak. You know, because I lived in Margaretville and Arkville, very rarely the power go out.
Yeah, where I'm at in Delhi, it's flickered a few times since I've owned the house and never gone out.
Yeah, you're right in the middle of Nice Egg or DCEC or whatever.
Yeah, it's a Nice Egg line there.
But I'm at the end of Central Hudson, and they just don't really go that way that much unless they have to.
And lately, it sounds like they've had to.
They had to. Those guys are awesome, though, man. Once they were there, 20 minutes later, the power was on. So
cool.
Pretty cool.
Well, how about the deer in the valleys, huh?
Yeah. The refugees of winter are on the side of the road, panhandling on bushes.
Yeah, that's no doubt. That's where the grasses emerged first, is right along the sides of the roads, and spring runs coming down out of the valleys. And just coming here to the studio tonight, we must have seen over 50 deer.
Yeah, probably more accurately, it would be dumpster diving on what little is growing where the snow has been removed by sunlight. Yeah,
a little bit of grass sticking up.
Yeah, south-facing sides and stuff like that.
Yeah, this is a tough one for deer this year. It's been a while since we had a tough one.
Yeah, they're not really a winter animal as much as people think. You know, moose are really long-legged for a reason, so they can move through those deep snows, 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet plus. Deer, you get above 2 feet, they are struggling.
Yeah, and moose can actually reach for food beyond their height. Deer can't. I learned this moose when I was hunting moose with a friend in Maine. He said you got to look for the sign of the moose pushing over red maple saplings. They'll actually straddle a 2 and 3 inch diameter sapling that might be 20 foot tall.
Really?
Push it over with its chest, because we're talking a 1,000-pound animal.
Yeah.
And it's long legs, so it's got a lot of leverage on this. Push it over and eat the buds all the way up the tree.
That's true.
As it walks.
Yeah.
So moose are different. They can get food. It doesn't matter how deep the snow.
Yeah, a little balsam fir is not going to stop a moose, huh?
I guess not.
Yeah, it's true.
You're right. Deer, I don't know. I've ceased taking walks very far since the snow got really deep. But up until then, I'd found three dead in the snow.
You found them because your dog can smell them.
Yeah. This is something I've... It's the first year having a dog for me, and man, she is sniffing things out that I never would have saw.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, she'll be digging through the 2 feet of snow, and out pops a deer leg, and then she will keep walking. She'll find the rest of it, the rib cage, and
yeah, I bet there was a lot of winter mortality this year. You know? There's no way of knowing because deer aren't really tracked that well, but I would think so.
Yeah, it makes sense, but every few years it'll happen.
We're actually gonna talk about deer more tonight.
All right.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the Forest Preserve Foreshadow. That's the name of tonight's show, and it's going to be a little philosophical, a little paradigm-y, you know? We're going to go into some environmental philosophy.
Oh, wow.
That's right. Put on your philosopher. Do you have glasses, John? Well, you should get some. You know? Because when you talk, glasses make you sound like or look like you know what you're talking about. You can take them off and really... emotional ways when you're really disgusted by something.
Just throw them off to the side. Well, I'll pop the lenses out of my sunglasses here quick, and we'll keep going with the show.
So, foreshadow. What does foreshadow mean, first of all? It means to present an indication or a suggestion of beforehand. It is an indication of something to come, right? So I'm going to argue tonight that the New York State Forest Preserve serves as one of the best examples of a quote-unquote foreshadow in natural resources management. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I've come to the conclusion that there's about four foreshadows of the Forest Preserve.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the Forest Preserve hasn't really changed that much, although it's been growing all along, and I'll talk about that. But it's really served as a litmus test or whatever of our culture surrounding environmental issues, I would say. The way we perceive it today, yesterday, and maybe in the future. That's what I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I'm ready to hear those 4 points you have.
Are you? Really?
Well, I know what they are. Foreshadowing.
Oh, all right. So, all right, let's talk about foreshadow number one, the preservation movement. All right, so 1904 and late 1800s. 80s or 90s, the Adirondack Forest Preserve was created. They're a little before the Catskill one. So 1904, the Catskill Forest Preserve was created. And that's Article 14 of the New York State Constitution, protected as forever wild. Right? This is an urban construct. I would argue it's an urban construct because it's mostly, from the city that this was created. That land should be permanently excluded from rural land uses. I mean, that's really what we're talking about, right? We're talking about not cutting trees. It can't be used for farming, agriculture, no cutting of trees, forestry, timber, tanning, whatever.
No clearing of land, right?
That's right. So really, we're removing rural land use from it, exclusively for recreation and observation. This is a time period when you have Central Park being created. A lot of parks are going up. And New York's kind of leading the way. They're foreshadowing this preservation movement that's about to spread from New York City and New York State into the Catskills, Adirondacks, and really throughout the country. You know, this kind of, let's just let it be. Leave it alone. And simply tore through it. You know, later on we see highways being built for scenic highways just to look at, like the Taconic, that's much later. But this is, to me, one of the first instances where you see this foreshadow of the preservation movement, right?
Okay.
You following me?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the Theodore Roosevelt National Monument, National Land.
Yeah. John Muir, the preservationist, versus Gifford Pinchot, who is a conservationist. And I would say Gifford Pinchot lost big time. We don't think of it as winning or losing, but I would say, culturally speaking, the preservation movement absolutely won.
And it's more popular.
And, it was a different time period. What was it, 80% or so of New York State was cleared for agriculture. So this is what some would call the era of exploitation. I don't say exploitation because it makes it sound like those people – I feel like they were doing the best they could with the technology they had in the 1800s. So I'm not going to look down upon them or play Monday morning quarterback. But – this was a time period where the land was used a lot.
Right.
And it kind of made – to put it in context, I can't blame the preservationists either for doing what they did, right? To have some areas that were wild, because a lot of that is in the American spirit, to have that wildness and whatnot. So, okay, it's foreshadowing this preservation movement, which I would say Muir over Gifford Pinchot, and even John Burroughs. John Burroughs is more of a conservationist kind of guy. He didn't mind seeing a few barns in the landscape, some kind of cows. He's talked about cows being beautiful. I mean, John Muir was strictly wilderness, the Sierras and all that. The wilder, the less people there were, the better. You follow me?
I am.
All right, so basically... But there's a downside to this too, and I used to be completely preservationist at one time, believe it or not, before the Ranger School where I went to school, and before I really got into forestry, I was really totally preservationist until I heard my New York State Ranger School professor, who became the director of the New York State Ranger School, and now I guess he just retired, but he said, realize that if you don't use your land wisely, you will have to use someone else's to procure resources, perhaps unwisely, too. And I was like, man, I can't argue with that.
So the best steward of the land is yourself.
Well, we're still using paper. We're still using wood products. We're just using someone else's forest.
Sure.
So is it preservation? Well, it is maybe locally. But, not really. We're using someone else's stuff.
Right.
So I couldn't argue with that, and I was like, geez, can't we do better in New York? Can't we use our own land? Have we not progressed past the 19th century? So, all right, whatever. So the preservation movement spreads throughout the country. New York State had some of the first parks in the country, and really the national park system comes around after this, right? And there's many national parks today, but a lot of people outside of New York State are shocked. They don't really realize that there's the Adirondack and Catskill Park, and they're both good and bad. So, all right, so that's foreshadow number one, the preservation movement, and not only that, I wanted to say that just because this was on public land, the preservation movement, but I would argue too, that it served as the biggest role model to private landowners on how to treat land. I think even to this day, private forest owners believe that not doing anything is the best. After all, isn't the state doing that?
Right, mostly.
There are state forests where timber management is allowed. And
wildlife management units, things like that.
Right, more rural land uses and conservation are allowed. But for the most part, the biggest role model is the state forest preserve. And hey, if you're not into forestry and forest management, well, why wouldn't you think? Yeah, I mean, that must be the only way to manage land.
Sure, I mean, they're the biggest landowner of New York State, so you know if that's what they're doing, let's follow suit. It's too easy to fall into.
Right. So I would say it spread from public land to also private land, and culture matters. So this culture now, all the while, the forests are growing. Right. See, when the Conservation Commission, which is now the DEC, created the Catskill Forest Preserve, this is a lot younger forest too, in many areas. But it's growing all along, right? 1904, now it's 2021. So, okay, foreshadow number two. Which one's that? The return of forests and fauna, right? I mean, if you read old newspaper clippings, late 1800s, early 1900s, deer would make the paper, right? Most people's grandparents in the Hudson Valley or the Catskills may have been at best grouse hunters, right? Maybe rabbit hunters. There were no deer.
I mean, even if that, I just read a pamphlet that one of the members of the Catskill Forest Association sent along. It was a diary entry from a gentleman from the Hamden area. His whole life was in there, from 25 years old to 76 years old when he died. Only once in the entire diary did he mention wildlife, and it was, "I saw a fox today."
Amazing.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
A fox. I saw a fox in his whole diary of his entire life.
Right. Now, mind you, there were game laws in the early 1900s. But what was there mostly in Delaware County?
Mostly farms.
Just open land. Straight up fields.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about this before, but the energy from the sun is going to grow grass for domestic life.
I shouldn't say that. There was a second wildlife that he mentioned every year that slipped my mind because he mentioned it so often was the number of woodchucks that he shot.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So there was that.
Right.
But he was a dairy farmer. I mean, that was kind of a thing to do. You had to protect your cow's legs because, I mean, at that time he only had 14 cows. So you lose one, that's a huge, huge income loss.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't until the late 1800s, that Americans now, because in the 1600s there were not Americans, they were settlers, actually successfully, in quotes, successfully cleared land and kept it down as grass. Before that, you know, 1600s, you have Dutch settlers coming in, English. If you're down south in Texas, it's Spanish, right? If you're up north, maybe it's French. You know, they may have cut some trees, but the trees grow back. They couldn't clear the land. So as it grows back, it becomes actually better wildlife habitat, right? They burn, they cut, stuff grows instantly back. In the Adirondacks, some of the deer herd was higher in the late 1890s, and I'll go into this later on. And that's because the lumber companies went through, but they didn't clear land. They cut, and then it instantly regenerates. So it actually creates this awesome deer habitat and grouse and everything else. I mean, I'm focusing on deer, and I'm going to focus on deer for another reason later on, you'll see. But deer are kind of that keystone species. So it's not until the late 1800s that our ancestors actually successfully keep the forest down, right? And now all the energy is going towards goats, sheep, cow.
Right.
Right, pigs.
And a big reason for that is we didn't have engines back then. We didn't have the gasoline engine. We didn't have the tractor.
Oh, yeah, horses. I forgot to mention how much land is dedicated to horsepower.
Absolutely right. I'm reading a book now that mentions an estimated horsepower is 30% of the land use, of the cleared land, was for hay for horses.
For horsepower.
So as soon as the tractor came along, boom, we didn't need 30% of this cleared land, of the 80% you were just mentioning. So there's where our forest instantly regrew.
Right there, man. That's a huge number.
Yeah.
People talk bad about fossil fuels, but you know what? Forests started growing when you didn't need horsepower. Now, there's the cost of that, but that's another radio show. Anyway, so the second foreshadow is the return of wildlife. So as these forests begin to grow, they're in preserves, and we see some lag time. As the forest first starts to grow back in the early 1900s, right, you have the Civil War. There's already farm abandonment in the higher elevations, which is where most of the forest preserve is. Then you have the Great Depression. You have World War One, then the Great Depression. Then you have World War II. Then you have the 70s, right? And a lot of farm abandonment reverting to forest. And first you're going to see the early successional species, right? Like rabbit, grouse, woodcock. And then finally, in the 50s, especially in the higher elevations that were abandoned earlier and acquired through the forest preserve, you start seeing hunting clubs, right?
Yeah. I'm a member to this day of one.
Yeah, because to this day, today, a lot of us don't understand why a lot of these hunting clubs are up there. There's fewer deer. It's more sporting. But there were more deer at one time back then in those areas.
Yeah. So our club was founded in 1954 from a group of guys out of the Delhi and Bovina area of Delaware County. So they moved their club to the western high peaks of Ulster County, Hardinburg, town of Hardinburg. And the reason was because there was game to hunt. There was deer to hunt.
Right.
And now, you know, a lot of those guys, they come for the camaraderie, but they go back home to shoot their deer back in Delhi and Bovina, the grandsons that are now taking over the club. But it was a horse pasture. This is the exact example we were just talking about. The land was given to them, gifted to them, 1 acre of land. It was an old dairy farm. It was part of the horse pasture that was being abandoned. It was the upper elevations that wasn't needed anymore. And they picked that spot, one, because the spring was there, but two, the second reason was the view of the mountain across the valley, and that's the mountain they hunted. Now you go there, there's no view.
Can't see it.
Long been gone. I cut 70-foot maple trees down for firewood for that camp now in front, maybe to one day see a glimpse of that mountain again.
Yeah, I bet.
So it was a pasture at the time. They ripped apart stone walls for the foundation of that camp.
Yeah.
And this is right around 2,300 feet in elevation or so.
2,200,
I guess.
So this is fitting perfectly into what we're talking about.
Exactly.
Right? That's right by, yeah. So that area of the forest preserve, town of Hardinburg, higher elevations, those were what we call hill farms, foreshadowed the return of wildlife as forests began to grow back. So first foreshadow is the foreshadow of the preservation movement. The second is forests start regrowing and wildlife coming back, which would later on happen throughout the rest of the state and the eastern seaboard. Eventually everyone's forests would come back, as we didn't use farms in the east of the Mississippi as much. Right? So forests are coming back, wildlife's coming back, hunters are following the wildlife, and that's the second foreshadow, right? Is this all making sense? Am I making any sense here?
I'm following along totally. I hope our listeners are too.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the third foreshadow next, about the maturing forest, because all the while the forests are growing, you know?
Right,
1904 to when your hunting club is established in the 1950s, all the while those stems are gaining diameter, height, densification of the forest, and we'll talk about the third foreshadow, maturing forest with decline of deer. What? How is that possible?
There are places I'll remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone, and some remain. All these places have their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning when I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. Affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. In my life, I love you more.
All right. Johnny Cash. So on From the Forest tonight, we're talking about the Forest Preserve foreshadow. We're talking the first foreshadow was how the Forest Preserve indicated the preservation movement and the coming of that and the spread of it throughout the whole state and the country. The second foreshadow was the return of wildlife as forest began to grow back inside those abandoned horse pastures, right? And the return of wildlife happened, generally speaking, as the shrub layer came in, rabbits could move in, songbirds, woodcock, whatnot, quail, whatever you want to call it, not here, but in other areas. And then the third foreshadow is maturing forests. Since our farms were abandoned earlier than the rest of the state. And when I say our, I mean the higher elevations of the Catskill Mountains. So Balsam Lake Mountain area, Slide Mountain Wilderness area, Wildlife Management Unit 3A, which is the high peaks of the Catskills. These were the hill farms that were abandoned the earliest. So now these places that were younger forests at one time, not all of them, some of them were never cut, but now are really growing to maturity. They have a head start on the rest of the state. So what are they foreshadowing in this time period? Right? I mean, what is going on here?
It's another transition time, right? The forest keeps aging out, that it doesn't stay young to hold that young cover for certain wildlife, especially grouse.
Yeah. And let me just, you know, concede that I like old forests. I go camping in these areas. Some really good trout streams, and they're beautiful areas for other reasons. I'm not going to take anything away from that. But it doesn't mean they're healthier for all conditions, and it depends on what you're doing. So let's look at deer. And a lot of people will wonder, why do we keep going back to the white-tailed deer? The reason why we go back to deer is because deer are that keystone species. And a keystone species is something that what?
A keystone species is one that uses such a broad range of habitat types and that it's usually a larger animal, like deer, that when its population is doing healthy and you manage for that population habitat, that you benefit all other species with it. It's an umbrella over all other species.
Yeah. It as it eats the forest vegetation, for example, below 6 feet, that impacts other fauna, species, wildlife that depend upon cover and food below 6 feet.
Right. A keystone species can manipulate its own habitat, too.
Yeah, so that's why if you don't satisfy the deer herd or have a healthy deer herd, it greatly impacts other species. So The first time I realized that this foreshadow was not well understood was when I was talking to a landowner that, thankfully, gives me permission to hunt on their land. And it was in Gardner, in the Walk Hill Valley, and there's a lot of deer down there because a lot of the land is still clear or has early successional and young forest or a variety of age classes, rather. And we're looking up at the mountain, and she says, why don't you hunt up there? I said, there's more deer down here by your house. She goes, what are you talking about? That's Minnewaska State Park. There's more deer. I mean, it's a preserve. I'm like, there's fewer deer up there because, there's not good habitat. And I had to go into what good habitat is and stuff. But I could see how people would misunderstand that, right?
Sure.
It makes sense. I mean, they're not allowing as much hunting up. Well, they do allow hunting there. But, it's a preserve. Why wouldn't there be more wildlife, right? Okay. So let's go into that. And the forest preserve foreshadows maturing forests throughout New York State and a reduction in some species of wildlife like deer. And I did some I got some data from the New York State DEC specifically for three wildlife management units, 3A, which is the highest elevations of the Catskills, 3C, which is mainly the Rondout Valley. So it has a little more younger growth because it was more farms in that area, but still a lot of forest land. I mean, all these areas are predominantly forest, but just abandoned more recently. And then 3J, which is mainly the Walk Hill Valley, New Paltz area, which was abandoned the most recently as a lot of young forest, like cedar trees, okay? A lot of stuff like that, open land. All right. Now, it can't be just about hunters because we had more hunters back in the day. Now, this COVID thing, we've had a big uptick in hunters this year, but the trend is still down. I found out that the hunting population in New York State peaked in 1984 at 712,000 people.
Wow.
Hunters. Isn't that shocking?
1984.
Damn.
Yeah, because people talk about the decline of hunters. You would just assume it was since, 2000s or 90s. It's a recent phenomenon. Yeah.
I try to not make any assumptions anymore because, I hear these things and I don't know if they're true or not. So I went back and looked at it. So it peaks in 1984. The Catskills, according to the DEC, and the lower Hudson Valley lost the most amount of hunters in the last 30 years in any other region in New York State. So we can't say it's because of overhunting is what I'm trying to prove here, that deer numbers have declined. All right, then what is it? What happened? Who is removing the deer?
The trees remove the deer.
Yeah. Maybe it's not all. Yeah, it's not shots down range. It's remember, all the while, the trees have been growing since 1904. And as the forest matured, it's not game laws, and I would argue it's not game laws or more or less hunters. It's actually the forest just maturing. And why is that? Why is it that mature forest leads to fewer deer?
Well, I mean, the closed canopy that they create allows less sunlight through it, and there's less sunlight available to grow an understory plant or a midstory tree that a deer can reach to browse and feed upon.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just far less. I used to know these numbers, how much browse was in a mature forest compared to a younger forest. It's significantly less.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you were just listening on a podcast. What do they have to say about how much more cutting there needs to be done to have good quality habitat for deer?
Yeah, so this was a Georgia study, so it's a little different than New York State. But trees' densities in forestry terms are measured in basal area. So some of our forests are exceeding 130 square feet of basal area. Area per acre, right?
You don't have to
know what that means. Yeah. Just know the numbers. So 130 here. These studies were talking about 80 being some peaking deer habitat in Georgia, but they were looking at the study better habitats at like 60 and 40.
Amazing, yeah.
So a third of the trees.
Yeah,
allows more sunlight through, and they're just looking at the forbs beneath, and they're also talking about quail in this study. So. That's a prairie grass species.
Yeah, good luck. That's tough. That's a tough thing to do. So, if you ever get the chance, read a book by C.W. Severinghouse. This guy was a biologist for the Conservation Commission, which is now the DEC. I think it was the Conservation Commission back in 1956. He wrote a book called History of the White-Tailed Deer in New York. It's a short read. It's 20-something pages. He goes through every region of New York State and talks about their populations and why they're increasing or decreasing. The Adirondacks, this will shock people. The Adirondacks is the big forest preserve. And they foreshadowed what I'm about to talk about, deer decline and forest maturing, way sooner than the Catskills. In fact, their deer herd, according to Severinghouse, peaked in the late 1890s. Why is that? And then New Paltz's, or 3J, in the Hudson Valley, Wallkill Valley, their deer herd peaked in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Is it because of hunting, game laws? No, it's all about habitat, man.
Right.
The lumber companies went through in the mid to late 1800s. In the Adirondacks, they created some a variety of age classes, created some deer mecca. And then, as that forest matured, the population peaks in the 1890s. The farms aren't abandoned in New Paltz or the Wallkill Valley until probably the mid-20th century or so. And then their deer population peaks in the 1990s. So, to me, I would argue it's all about habitat, or mostly thereof. Habitat trumps everything. So let's get back to the Catskills. Catskills, I got some data here from the DEC, and it looks like for 3J, which is the Wallkill Valley, and 3C, the Rondout Valley, the deer numbers, the deer herd peaked in about the late 90s to early 2000s. 3J peaked the most recent. That makes sense. They have the youngest forest. And 3C peaked a little bit earlier than that. And 3As, which is the most mountainous area, that covers from Woodstock to West Shokan to Margaretville, all of town of Hardenburg, Denning, the most mature, highest elevation forests, they only gave it back to 1988. But their population was higher in 1988 than it way higher than it was in 2019. Let's just say that.
Yeah, and the data shows a pretty linear trend from 1988 all the way to 2004, where it benches out and becomes pretty stagnant in 3A, meaning I think we've reached its potential.
And what's even more shocking, I was looking at the graph just before the show. I can't even think of this. I mean, John, you go hunting in 3A all the time. If you see a deer, sometimes that's a good day.
Yeah.
Just think, in 1988, they were shooting, the total deer take was almost as high as it was taking a deer in 3J, like New Paltz, where I grew up.
That's incredible.
I mean, when I went hunting in New Paltz, if you didn't see five deer, you were mad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that.
I tell you, I've walked a lot of miles just to see a flash of a tail.
About that. Oh, my God. Now, I talked to an old family. He was on the radio show, Ray Muthig of the Neversink area. Their family's been in that area a long time. Now, this is anecdotal, but when he came on the radio show, we got talking about hunting. And he claimed that there were way more deer in the Frost Valley area. Again, this is 3A, 50s through the 70s. Way more deer. So I don't have data going back that far, but from 1988, far more deer than 2019. So the forest preserve now is foreshadowing maturing forests and now deer decline to where the forest preserve has the fewest deer in the whole state. 3A and some areas of the high elevations of the Adirondacks have the fewest deer per square mile than anywhere in the rest of the state. All right. So that's a foreshadow, I would think, of things to come. And every area is peaking out, or already did. Every other WMU is peaking out.
Right. Well, and that's because the private landowner is generally taking the same route as the forest preserve, doing nothing, letting the trees grow.
Yeah. So, okay, I know what people might be saying. Hey, if deer are going down, doesn't that mean that there's going to be growth and forest regeneration? This might be a good thing, right? I mean, intuitively, that makes sense. Fewer deer means maybe tree seedlings will start to grow in our forest again, right?
Maybe I don't have to fence my garden.
That's right. We'll talk about that next.
say it's true. They got a message from the Action Man. I'm happy, hope you're happy too. I've loved all of needed love, saw the details fall away. The shrieking of nothing was given, just pictures of trap girls in synthesis. And I ain't got no money, and I ain't got no hands. But I'm hoping to kick with the planet is glowing. Ashes to ash and fun to funk it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's high.
Okay, that's David Bowie, and you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is the Forest Preserve Foreshadow. Let me just say real quick, if you're wondering why, how could there be less deer now? And I just wanted to say this real quick. Deer are not equally distributed across the landscape. You're seeing most of the deer on the side of the road or near your house because that's where the young habitat is.
Tonight is a perfect example of that.
Perfect.
Geez, we just drove here 11 miles from Margaretville and saw over 50.
Yes, at least.
But, I mean, that's just because that's where all the snow was melted up. But that was all the deer. I mean, we were imagining that must be all of the deer in that valley is right there that we saw.
Oh, yeah. I would confidently say that. So, let's just recap for a second. So, the Forest Preserve Foreshadow, what are we talking about? And we're covering four foreshadows tonight. Say that four times fast. One is the preservation paradigm, that it kind of, you know, foreshadowed the whole preservation movement that spread throughout the country. The second was, as these preserves were created, there was forest regrowth that first occurred there and then spread throughout the whole rest of the country. And as the forest grew back, wildlife came back throughout the forest preserves and then everywhere else. Okay, and then the third was, now those forests are becoming mature forests. And that's also happening throughout the rest of the state and the eastern seaboard. And then we see deer decline because mature forests actually don't offer as much food for species like deer, especially grouse, ground nesting songbirds,
wild turkey,
wabbits, all that. Okay? So now we're at the fourth foreshadow. And I think the fourth foreshadow is pretty interesting, right? It's counterintuitive. You think, well, there's fewer deer. So that means stuff should start growing on the forest floor. Instead, the forest preserve is actually foreshadowing a barren understory. These deer are still impacting the forest floor despite 4 to 8 deer per square mile in some of these areas of 3A. How is that possible?
They just can keep up with it. The walk I took today at lunchtime said it all.
Yeah.
I walked the hillside. It was a mixed hemlock, red oak, maple stand, right? And snow's pretty shallow at this point, and there were deer tracks as far as I can see. There wasn't a bit of ground that had not been stepped on by a deer.
Right.
And that says a lot because we have had this snowpack consistently for almost 2 months now. So it shows where every deer has stepped for the last 2 months, and it covers the entire forest floor. So it gave a good example of a region in 3A that is, you know, the few deer that are there can impact the whole landscape. And they're there browsing everything on that forest floor. Every tree seedling that I found had some bit of browse on it.
Right. So there's fewer deer, but there's also fewer plants growing in the shady understory of a maturing forest. They keep up with it. And this is really disconcerting because I used to hear from biologists and deer managers and stuff, well, if we just shot more deer, we would start getting forest regeneration. And the forest preserve, I think, spits in the face of that. It says, no, you're going to have to cut and make better habitat as well, and maybe shoot deer. Not just shoot deer.
Right.
You're going to have to do better. And that's a weird thing. So, you know, you can go up in the upper Beaverkill, for example, right in the heart of 3A. And if it is covered with fern, indicating what? That the deer are eating everything else except for what they don't like, which is fern. And it used to be beech. That's like dumpster diving. Now they're even eating beech in Grahamsville, everywhere, because there's just nothing else to eat. And so, again, since the deer aren't satisfied and they're not happy, nothing grows in the forest floor, so all the other wildlife species are impacted that need that vegetation for cover.
You know, and most people don't realize this because they still see deer. They still have problems in their gardens and their yards, and their forsythia is eaten in the spring. And well, that's just because that's where the deer come to eat every night.
The browse pressure has actually gotten worse because now, when the deer used to be in the forest that was better habitat, that habitat has matured. So now they're pressuring areas that have better habitat, younger plants, which is right where we live. I mean, when I first lived anecdotally in Margaretville, when I first moved to Margaretville in 2007, people were unaware of deer browse in their gardens. And I believed them because I would look at arborvitaes that were planted and they weren't browsed. And then we had a few bad winters from around 2008, 9, or 10. It was some deep snow. And the deer started to come out of the woodwork, literally, and browse the daylights out of people's arborvitaes. And people were shocked. And it hasn't gone away now. Now the deer are here to stay, and they are browsing because that forest, as it got more mature, they started pressuring the areas near roadsides, gardens, whatnot. And it's not going to go away. So now the deer population has plateaued at this low level, this disgustingly low level, I would argue, but whatever. And yet the browse pressure has plateaued at this high level. This is not good.
Right.
Which leads us to the last foreshadow.
And?
It's 4+1.
Is it what do we do?
Yeah, of course, John. I mean, come on, we got to do something. We can't just be doom and gloom. I don't like that. Do you like shows like that?
No.
Stinks. There's a lot of those shows out there. I don't want to do that. No, this is actually totally reversible. Because you just need to cut trees, not just willy-nilly. You know, you probably should cut the right trees. You know, we can go into that. We have gone into that many times. A lot of people might say, well, we just released cougars and stuff. I would say, no way. That's not good enough. Listen, the human being has been the number one predator of white-tailed deer since white-tailed deer and human beings were around. I'm going to argue that all the time. I mean, I was reading this one guy's, what is it? Herbert Kraft, who wrote the book on the Lenape. They used to do all sorts of archaeological studies on diggings and stuff, Native Americans. And the amount of bones they found of deer representing all age classes was immense. Human beings lived off of deer for a long time. And I think we're the most significant hunter. Also, Native Americans burn the living daylights out of the forest to produce younger plants. Right? They were managing their forest. So now we've come full circle. Remember the first foreshadow of the forest preserve? It's coming together. I'm reeling it in here now, John. Just get ready.
Right. So the preservation paradigm.
Right. I think the next foreshadow might be the conservation movement. Right? Maybe Pinchot will finally win.
After 125 years.
I'm not going to say the preservation movement wasn't a success. I think in its time, it was. I just think in the 21st century, not the 19th or the 20th, that we can do better, that we finally need to revisit wise use, right? We need to get back involved, stop being a tourist, stop being a mere observer of nature, and start getting involved. Roll up your sleeves and start cutting the right trees. We can do better than this. And unlike our ancestors, we have the option to. We don't have to rely upon horsepower. We can actually, like, not cut some trees and cut others because it's, like, something we want to do or not do. You know what I mean? We have the option.
Right.
So could this be the foreshadow of a paradigm change? Finally, swinging the pendulum back or whatever, I don't know, back, towards, forward, a conservation movement. And these two terms get butchered all the time. They get used synonymously. They don't mean the same thing. Right? Am I just making any sense?
Yeah. So are you going to explain the difference between a conservation and a preservationist?
Man, I thought I did, but it didn't make sense. No. Preservationist is mainly the removal of rural land uses, mainly for recreation. Basically hands off, you know. It's what I used to call a museum forest, you know, something to look at. Conservation is wise use, so it's basically you can do stuff in the forest. You know, we can live locally off of our land. I would say the one finite resource in the world is land. It's the most precious finite resource. And to waste it or not use it locally, again, like my professor said at the Ranger School, you'll have to use someone else's resources. And I think we can do better than that now. I'm not saying we're going to overturn the forest preserve. A lot of other people and foresters much older than me have been arguing we should cut the forest preserve. You know what? The forest preserve has survived. They didn't cut a tree back when it was more fashionable, when people were starving in the Great Depression. They still didn't change the Constitution then. I doubt they'll do it today, okay?
I don't think we're calling for that.
Yeah.
It's
we got private land. Let's do it on private land first.
Right, exactly. Let's educate private landowners to do the right thing here. Like, it could be something small, very small.
Yeah.
Releasing an oak tree, releasing an apple tree, cutting that maple that's about to shade it out, use that for firewood. Cut that maple tree in February when the snow's getting deep, and the deer could eat on that.
Yeah.
And they're not browsing the seedlings at that moment.
Right. Yeah. This isn't an anti-forest preserve show. It's just really what you can do on your land right now. This is reversible. You know? There are things you can do, just like you said. So, and we've covered that many times on From the Forest, but yeah. Find that oak tree, release it, make some younger forest out there. So, I don't know what else you got, John.
You can do a lot, and it doesn't have to be all young forest either. You know, you could manage for keep an older forest type, but just keep the right trees within it. You know, like those oak; those are the ones that are going to be replaced eventually by maple.
Right.
So just cut the maple out, and you still have an older forest type.
Yeah.
You know, be the steward. We can treat a forest like a sliding time scale and be the timekeeper here. And if you want to reset the clock, go for it. That's fine, too. It will be a forest again.
Yeah, maybe this didn't come out clear enough, but there are costs to doing nothing. So far, I feel like for the last 100 years, we have only talked about the benefits of doing nothing, which is letting it be a forest preserve. We have not talked about the costs. The costs are at the expense of fruit and nut trees and younger plants. That's what the forest preserve, that's what the cost is.
And all wildlife that depend on those.
Right. for some things, the forest preserve is really good. You know, you're a black bear, you're doing just fine. You can climb up a tree.
Scarlet tanager, doing okay.
Yeah, you're doing great. All right, fisher, sure. I'll go kill a porcupine, right? Because I'm a fisher. And that's what I do. I'm a crazy animal, right? But if you're a deer who doesn't have access to a nice stepladder or a rabbit that is basically sitting naked in the forest floor waiting to be fox bait, you're donezo, right? If you're a gray squirrel that needs acorns, you're packing up and leaving the forest preserve. All right, you're out of there. You're going to the Hudson Valley somewhere where a farm was just abandoned and there's still an oak tree on a stone wall or something, or an apple tree that's some legacy from an agricultural period, something like that.
Sure.
Okay, so we haven't talked about the cost. And I always say if someone isn't giving you the benefits and the cost of any issue, they're trying to sell you something, an agenda, whatever. You need to know the benefits and costs, and then you make up your own mind. You know? If you're doing maple sugaring, don't cut trees as much, because maple trees will be just fine if we don't cut another tree. They can survive in the shade. They'll be just fine.
Sure.
And on that note, I'm going to go see if my maple trees actually ran some sap tonight. That's all the time we have on From the Forest.
All right. Well, let's watch some water boil, make some syrup, and we'll touch back next week.
Okay. Take care.
Good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their game. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, the big jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men come. Never sleeps, and to an old forgotten soldier, the dawn will come no more, for the old man has come home.